Welcome back to Case of the Sunday Scaries. I'm Elise, and I am feeling and probably looking a little bit rough right now. It was quite the week, let's just say that. And I wish I was using today's episode for a nervous system reset, but today's case certainly is not going to be providing that. I am starting a deep dive into the story of perhaps one of the most notorious American serial killers, Ted Bundy. This is going to be a multi-parter because, unfortunately, there is just so much to cover and so many victim stories to tell. But to understand what would eventually happen, we always have to start at the beginning with Ted Bundy's background. Before we get started, I want to remind you that I do my best to provide factual information based on publicly available sources, and I use that research to form my own opinion about these cases, but it is just that. My opinion, and is certainly not meant to harm anyone discussed in these episodes. With that said, let's dive into today's case.
Let's say you're a guy who's just got these fantasies. What brings a person to the point where he acts out a fantasy? You know, where he goes from thinking about it, doing it?
It's a very difficult thing to describe. The sensation of the reaching that point where I knew it was like something had, say, snapped, that I knew that I couldn't control it anymore, that these barriers that I had learned as a child, that had been instilled in me, were not enough to hold me back with respect to seeking out and harming somebody.
When we discuss nature versus nurture and what even makes a killer, Bundy's name often stands out from the group. Psychologists and criminal profilers have studied him extensively. But what makes Ted Bundy so frightening, at least to me, is how even when looking into his past, his early life, some of the typical warning signs of the evil that would develop just really aren't there. Yeah, he went through some difficult times, but to hear Ted himself describe it, his childhood was quite pleasant. And in the argument of nature versus nurture, could Ted Bundy truly have been born to be a killer? Did he possess from birth intelligence, darkness, and personality traits that would predispose him to become the prolific serial killer that he became? And if so, was there any way to prevent him from becoming the monster that he did? I'm going to let you guys decide. Theodore Robert Cowell was born on November 24th, 1946 in Vermont. His mother, whose name was Eleanor, but she went by Louise, was pretty young and unfortunately didn't have Ted's father in her life, and so she gave birth to Ted at the Elizabeth Lund Home for Unwed Mothers. Wow, that's a mouthful. But also, it's just fascinating that it wasn't that long ago that they had places like this. As for Ted's father, well, that still remains a mystery. On his original birth certificate, it listed a veteran named Lloyd. But Louise would claim to some that it was actually a war veteran named Jack who impregnated her, and he left her as soon as he found out she was pregnant. But the most disturbing theory held by some of his own family members was that Ted was actually a product of an abusive, incestual relationship between Louise and her own father. Of course, we have no idea if this is true or not, but Ted sure would take after the alleged traits of his grandfather slash possible father. Ted's mother did not think that she could keep Ted. She actually wanted to give him up for adoption. Being an unwed mother during that time had quite the social stigma. But her parents, Samuel and Eleanor, yes, another Eleanor, this is going to get quite confusing, this family tree, perhaps circle. They came up with a plan. They would raise Ted as their own son instead of as their grandson. And Ted's mother would just play the part of his older sister, which, wowza, that would make for a very confusing home dynamic. However, they did it out of love, I guess, for their daughter, not wanting basically society to look down on her or potentially to cover up what was going on inside that home. But here's where the story gets even a little bit more fuzzy than it already was. Ted and other family members said in interviews in 1987, that was after Ted was arrested, that his grandfather was an alcoholic with a wild and abusive temper. They said that he would constantly abuse his wife and daughters, even pushing one of his daughters down the stairs at one point just because she overslept. Hasn't he ever heard of like splashing a little cold water on them or something to learn the lesson? No, apparently he threw her down the stairs. He was also rumored to be unkind to small animals, beating their own family dog and picking up neighborhood cats and swinging them by their tails, which, if you know, you know. His grandmother allegedly was a timid woman who was afraid to ever leave her home and was mentally unwell. Now, if this truly was what Ted witnessed at a very early age, some of his later behaviors might make sense. Many times the abused become the abuser. However, I don't know if any of this is true, because in earlier interviews, Ted said nothing but positive things about his grandfather, and people close to the family and Ted's own cousin would say that Sam Cowell was a very good man. He never abused people or animals, his daughters adored him, and that Ted and his family had said all this bad stuff about Samuel in an effort to explain some of Ted's later behavior, basically to shift blame. Ted himself in early interviews really only had kind things to say about both of his grandparents. But as you will see throughout this episode, Ted is not a reliable narrator. That boy is a liar, liar, pants on fire. He will lie about anything to portray the image that he wants. So maybe Ted really did experience abuse and he even repressed it. He doesn't remember himself. Unfortunately, no one will probably ever know. And who's to say really which story is even true? I often say that no one really knows what's happening in a relationship besides the two people that are in that relationship. So I don't think it's that big of a stretch to say that no one knows what's happening behind the closed doors of a family home besides those living in it. For one reason or another, when Ted was about 4 years old, his mom Louise took him from Vermont all the way to Tacoma, Washington to live with relatives. And pretty shortly after, she met a man named Johnny Bundy at a church singles night, and the two hit it off immediately. Johnny married Louise later that same year, and he went out of his way. Not only was he a great stepdad, but he adopted little Ted, changing Ted's last name to what would later become the infamous Ted Bundy. Louise had found herself a very good man. Not only had he adopted Ted, but he really wanted to form a father and son relationship with him. He invited him camping and to do all these activities together, but it seems that Ted really could never emotionally connect to his stepfather. However, the opposite seemed to be true about the four other children that his parents would have together. Ted loved his siblings and having the role of an older brother. He even babysat them after school most days. Other than his own siblings, it seemed like Ted liked to spend a lot of time alone and had a speech impediment, same, that made him a little self-conscious when communicating with his peers.
Could you describe for us Ted's early childhood and his upbringing? How did you raise Ted?
Well, we tried to be very conscientious parents, ones who did things with our children, gave them the best we could give them on a middle-class income. But mostly we wanted to give them lots of love.
There's varying reports, but it does seem that during his early adolescent years, Ted started some not so great behavior. He kind of turned into a peeping Tom and would sneak out at night and peek into neighborhood windows, and he also started stealing. In his high school years, Ted really didn't seem to be winning any popularity contest. He was not the homecoming king. Now, he wasn't bullied or an outcast by any means, but Ted would say about his own high school years, "I don't know what made people want to be friends. I didn't know what underlay social interactions. Some people perceived me as being shy and introverted. I didn't go to dances. I didn't go on the beer drinking outings. I was pretty, you might call me straight, but not a social outcast in any way." I think it was this time that Ted was learning how to split his life. He was peering into women's windows at night and stealing, and yet still could fly under the radar. He never got caught. Ted thought pretty highly of himself. He had ambitions of becoming a lawyer, a politician, being someone that people really admired, someone that got the ladies, someone that would be respected. Like many teens, Ted saw going to college as his opportunity to change the narrative. He would become the man he always knew he should be. After a year of attending the University of Puget Sound, Ted transferred to the University of Washington. It was around this time that he really started paying attention to politicians, and he would mirror their behavior in their speeches, smiling, talking with precision, and making constant eye contact. He even volunteered on a local political campaign, and being part of this campaign, he met a lot of new people he hadn't been exposed to before, and he had a lot more social activities to take part in. In 1967, he would meet one important woman in particular, a University of Washington student named Diane, and she became Ted's first girlfriend. I am purposefully not sharing pictures of Diane or her last name because she wanted to remain private, and I obviously want to respect that. But Ted was head over heels smitten with her. At 20 years old, he was in love, or at least Ted's version of love, for the first time. And Diane represented everything he believed the perfect woman to be. A woman that could stand by his side in his lawyer or political ambitions. And Ted himself described her as a beautiful dresser, beautiful girl, very personable, nice car, great parents. I think Diane probably did what so many of us do, which is to fall in love with the potential she saw in Ted. Ted had taught himself how to be charming and charismatic, and she fell for it, hook, line, and sinker, at least at first. It was not long until Diane felt that Ted had fallen in love with the idea of her, with her status and upbringing, of the life they could have together, of being this power couple. She later would say that he was pitifully weak when it came to her, but that she noticed he would befriend other people in order to use them for his own personal gain. She was seeing behind the confident exterior that he exuded to the insecure little boy that wanted her undying affection, and to probably the numerous personality disorders that allowed Ted to manipulate others. And in a rather shocking turn, Ted ended up dropping out of college, which is quite an odd choice for someone who wants to become a lawyer or a politician. It's kind of a prerequisite, right? He went on to work some interesting odd jobs. He even worked for a time as a driver and a bodyguard for a man who was running for governor. But Diane had an idea for the life that she wanted, and Ted just simply wasn't measuring up. He talked of ambition and drive and all these dreams for the future, and yet he was not delivering. And Diane, for I'm sure numerous reasons, decided to end their courtship. Now here's the thing. People are allowed to end relationships. That is sort of the whole point of dating, is it not? You get to know someone, see if you can intertwine your lives, find out if you're even compatible. And then, if not, you're allowed to break up with someone and move on. We have all had our heart broken by someone. You hurt for a bit, then you collect yourself and move forward. But not Ted. He could not handle this rejection. He was so enamored and focused on this life that he had dreamed of building with Diane that this heartbreak sent him into a spiral. Every insecurity from his childhood, every feeling of abandonment, of not being natural in social interactions, of all the work he had to put into just to get a woman like Diane, it all came to the surface. And instead of laying in bed for a day or two, drowning his heartbreak with a pint of ice cream, Ted remembered wanting to hurt Diane, to get revenge on her for breaking his heart. Unfortunately, from my own personal experience, I know all too well that some people, do not like being told no. They take rejection as an insult to their character, to their worth, and then that insecurity, it turns to anger. And thankfully, Ted never physically followed through with his desire to cause Diane harm. But I don't think it's a coincidence that the woman that Ted would later go on to target, most of them had very similar features to Diane. They were young, college-age women, slender with brown hair parted in the middle. He couldn't take out his rage against the woman that he claimed to love. I don't think Ted knows what love is, but since he couldn't take it out on Diane, he stalked and murdered women that bore her likeness. Ted came over this way to Colorado, then Arkansas, and then enrolled for a semester of college in Philadelphia. And we really don't know a whole lot about this time from 1968 to 1969, but it's believed that it was around this time that Ted found out the truth about who his birth parents really were. Either he got a copy of his original birth certificate or someone in the family handed it to him. I don't know. We don't know exactly how this came to be. Everything Ted knew was true suddenly wasn't. His older sister that had raised him was really his mother. And his dad, well, no one even knew who that was. According to his mom, it was a guy who ditched her when she became pregnant. And according to his birth certificate, it was someone else entirely. And according to rumor, the man he thought was his dad might have actually been his dad and his grandpa. ugh, that's gross. I honestly would have loved to be on the other side of a paper-thin wall when Ted called his mother to have that conversation. And I'm not going to discredit that this would throw anyone's world completely off kilter. It would be awful, especially to someone who already seems to not be able to handle anything resembling rejection or abandonment. I can even, and I really never thought these words would come out of my mouth, I can have empathy for young Ted. He probably felt a huge sense of abandonment that even though his older sister and her husband, which was really his mom and stepdad, did their best by him, he must have felt like his parents, who were really his grandma and grandpa, didn't want him when they allowed his sister, really his mom, to move him all the way across the country. He must have thought, they don't even want me. They're letting my sister take me away from them. We all want love and acceptance from our parents. It's kind of biologically programmed into us. But what if the people you're seeking that from turn out to not even be your parents? That would mess with anyone's head. Also, this whole like mother, sister, grandma, mom, stepdad, sister, husband, grandfather. I'm confusing myself. So I truly cannot imagine how confusing this was for Ted. And Ted had something to prove. His home life had turned into an episode of Jerry Springer, or maybe Maury, like, you are not the father, except they never figured out who was. And his girlfriend had just left him. Ted could not have this. He, Theodore Bundy, was determined to be something great. So he made his way back to University of Washington to enroll as, get this, a psychology major. And you have to wonder why. Obviously, I understand that this could be a great prerequisite for law school or I guess even for his political aspirations, but Ted Bundy studying psychology is a very strange image in my head. And Ted wasn't a dummy. In fact, it's believed his IQ was around 136, which is considered intellectually gifted. For the first time, he was getting really good grades. And in 1971, Ted Bundy got a job at Seattle's Suicide Crisis Center hotline. Ted Bundy was actually at a job where he could potentially be saving people's lives. Let's just sit with that for a second. I know I can feel it that I'm about to go off on a tangent, but just stay with me here. I want you to imagine this. Ted Bundy answered phones during the most critical point in someone's life, and he had to convey enough empathy, enough compassion to not only be believable, but to be helpful to these people that were making these calls, to make people in despair believe someone really heard them and cared for them. I sincerely hope people were helped by him, and it sounds like, from the lady that worked with him at the time, Ted was really good at this job. But knowing what we know about Ted now, I do not believe for a second that Ted Bundy possessed the capacity for empathy. And please hear me when I say that I am in no way giving him any praise, but it is terrifying and fascinating, if I'm being honest, that someone who many people would now diagnose as a psychopath was able to mirror the emotions of others that he probably never truly felt. Think about this. Let's say you're having a bad day. You're really sad something happened to you. And you are walking down the street and someone asks, hey, is everything okay? You didn't say anything. How would people pick that up? Well, we are taught from a very young age to read the mannerisms in people, right? When you're sad, you might have tears in your eyes, but the smaller things, the furrow of a brow, having your eyes downcast, and like the corners of your lips turned down, all of these are tiny little things that we do to convey emotion to others. And actors do this all the time for roles. They mimic the emotion that's conveyed in the words of the script. But the idea of being on, to be performing and succeeding at making people believe that the character you're portraying in your everyday life is who you actually are, it's wild that he was able to do that. This is what makes Ted Bundy so unique from other serial killers. And honestly, maybe this is the unspoken thing about him that made so many people fascinated with his crimes. Ted Bundy had seemingly mastered what it took to appear charming and disarming to his victims, when underneath the facade that he so artfully and very carefully curated was this sick, twisted sadist that was capable of unbelievable evil. I just can't imagine, and again, I'm not praising him, but he had to be unbelievably intelligent in picking up all of these tiny little social cues that you would think that someone that doesn't possess those emotions themselves wouldn't even notice. It's wild. Anyway, back to the story. Ted has left Philadelphia, he's back in Washington, and he meets another young woman who would be in his life for a very long time, a single mother named Elizabeth who worked as a secretary at the University of Washington. And I hate this. I hate this with my whole heart, because her sweet daughter, who was only 3 at the time, named Molly, she thought of Ted as a father figure. And I hate this for both of them, because I truly believe that Ted Bundy used these two women as a pawn. It was two more actors who, unbeknownst to them, were playing a supporting role in making Ted look like a family man, someone to be trusted. Ted then graduates college, he takes his LSATs, and ends up actually being accepted into law school. But during the summer, he started working and volunteering for all sorts of different political figures. Ted even landed himself a job as the assistant to the chairman of the Washington State Republican Party. He had everybody fooled at this point, even politicians. And in the summer of 1973, Ted's job would take him to California. Do we remember who lives in California? Well, he picks up his phone, gives a little ring jingle, and calls up his old flame Diane. Hey, hey girl, hey, I'm in California, let's meet up. And meet up they did. And she was really impressed with how Ted had finally matured and applied himself. So much so that she decided to give him another chance. What Diane and Elizabeth did not know was that the other person even existed, and that he was carrying on relationships with both of these ladies. And Ted, I'm sure, was absolutely delighting in the attention and adoration that he was receiving from both women and the young girl who looked up to him as a dad. In the fall of that year, Ted started at Seattle Law School, continuing with his coursework and his deception of Diane and Elizabeth. But come January, Ted was over it. He cut off all contact with Diane. He ghosted her. Well, at least whatever the 1970s equivalent of ghosting was. He didn't answer her letters or phone calls. But when Diane finally got a hold of him by phone, she asked him, like, Ted, what is going on? How could you do this to me? Ted calmly responded, Diane, I have no idea what you mean, and hung up the phone on her. Like, you want to talk about gaslighting? They were in a relationship, and she's calling to be like, what is going on? Like, how in the world could you just, like, end this without even having a conversation with me? And he just says, whatever do you mean? Oh, I can't even imagine. And Diane was obviously devastated. But to Ted, this was his plan the entire time. He was playing this long con. He had said about Diane later, I just wanted to prove to myself that I could have married her. She had heard him, and he spent years trying to show that he could be the type of man that she had wanted. Ambitious, determined, a man who applied himself academically, professionally. And when he had the law school acceptance letter and the fancy political job, he pursued her to intentionally then reject her, just as he felt she had rejected him. I wish that Ted's need for revenge, to hurt people, to cause people unbelievable pain, stopped right here in this moment, right? He got his revenge. He got Diana. He really showed her. Imagine if he had just, like, went on and become a politician or something. But if that was the case, if he had stopped right there with that rude phone call to Diane, then I wouldn't be sitting here talking to you today about Ted Bundy. And because he didn't need law school anymore, really it was just a tool in his plan to win back Diane, he stopped going to classes. And it was around this time that young women in the area started to disappear. It's speculated that Ted Bundy's first murder may have happened way before this time period, but we probably will never really know. There is a speculation that when Ted was 14, he lived around the block from an 8-year-old little girl named Anne Marie, who was taken from her bed in the night and never found. In fact, someone, remember he was a peeping Tom, had seen that her window was unlocked, put a little stool under it, and climbed into her window and removed her. Case is still open to this day, and Ted actually corresponded through letters to Anne Marie's mother while he was in jail, and he promised he had nothing to do with Anne Marie's disappearance. But this is Ted Bundy, and he told so many people so many different versions of the truth that it's hard to make out what is fact or what is the fictional tale of someone who just wanted people to hear him talk, to toy with investigators and media and the mom of a daughter who disappeared at 8 years old. I think it's fair to say, like we've discussed in previous episodes, that most serial killers do have a pattern of escalation. So sadly, I'm sure there were other people that were victimized in some way by Ted Bundy before the victims that we are aware of. What we do know is that the first attack that we absolutely know Ted Bundy committed was in January of 1974. He had just gotten his revenge on Diane. He had ghosted her. Maybe he thought that that would be enough to curb that desire for violence and revenge towards her. But tragically, it wasn't. And before we move forward, I want to make this very clear. What Ted Bundy would do to his victims is deplorable. It's not human. And going forward from this point, it's going to be rough. There's going to be discussion of sexual assault and just a lot of things. It's a lot. So I just want to give you fair warning. On January 4th, Karen Sparks, an 18-year-old college student, was at her apartment that she shared with roommates, just reading, laying in bed reading for the night, when she looked up and for just a second thought she saw a man peering into her window. Of course, she was spooked, but as we often do, she convinced herself she didn't actually see that. Karen said later, quote, "I remember seeing some guy looking at me and I thought, gosh, you know, maybe it was just a figment of my imagination because it was so quick. It was just a flash. And I thought, well, no, nobody's going to hurt me, you know. I'm living with all these guys, you know. I mean, who's going to hurt me?" End quote. The answer to that question was Ted Bundy, because he snuck into Karen Sparks' basement apartment after she had fallen asleep that night. He used a metal rod from her own bed frame to hit her repeatedly over the head while she slept, and used that same metal rod to sexually assault her. Karen believes that it was because of her male roommate that she even survived. He had a probably, on most normal occasions, annoying habit of talking in his sleep, but in this case, a remarkably lucky habit, because Karen believes Ted heard her roommate talking and it spooked him, so he took off before he could finish the job. Karen's injuries were so severe that once she was found hours later by her roommate and taken to the hospital, Karen remained unconscious for 10 days. She also had extensive internal injuries from the assault, so much so that even her bladder was ruptured. Karen did survive, but she had significant brain damage and had lost most of her hearing and vision.
My roommate Bob thought I was still sleeping. Later on, he went down and checked me again, and there he found the blood, and it was just horrible for him to find me that way. And the next thing I remember was waking up in the hospital, and I thought, uh-oh, this is really bad. This is really bad. And so I asked my father, I said, "Dad, what happened?" And he said, "Well, you had a little bump in your head."
In what may be the only bit of grace besides her survival in this experience was that Karen remembers nothing of the attack itself. Of course, it would have been great if she could have helped police and described Ted Bundy, right? But she does not deserve to remember the horrible atrocities that Ted Bundy inflicted on her.
Linda lived here in this greenhouse in the University District along with 5 other university students. She was last seen here Thursday evening about 12 o'clock.
Less than 1 month later, on February 1st, Ted Bundy broke into the basement of 21-year-old Linda Healy. Linda was a very popular student at the University of Washington. She even ran a morning weather and ski report to make a little extra side cash at a local radio station. It's likely that Ted had seen her on campus and had stalked her, following her home, and that's probably how he knew that her and her female roommates left a key in their mailbox, and using that knowledge, Ted slipped into her room undetected. The next morning, Linda's alarm went off and
off
and off, and it just kept going. So her roommate even walked into her room and shut off the alarm, but was pretty surprised to not see Linda there. She wasn't in her room or the house at all. And what became more worrisome was when the very responsible Linda never showed up for work, which clearly was not like her. Her roommates called the police, and when the police entered her room, everything looked to be in order. Maybe she had taken off in the middle of the night, went to a party, went and met up with someone. Even Linda's bed was perfectly made. But when they pulled back her bedspread, there was blood on Linda's sheets and on her pillow. A nightgown hung in her closet with a ring of dried blood around the neck, and her pillowcase and school backpack were missing. Later, we would find out that Ted had gone into her room, beaten Linda in her sleep until she was unconscious. He then undressed her from her nightgown and redressed her in her own blue jeans, blouse, and boots, and literally carried her off into the night. After remaking her bed and setting everything back the way it was, and I don't know if it's adrenaline or if Ted was just unusually strong for his size because he wasn't that big of a guy, but I am shocked that he was able to do all this, to carry an unconscious woman who is basically just, you know, dead weight out of her room, up four steps to the side door, and slip off into the night without waking anybody else in the home. He then drove Linda to a secluded area where he sexually assaulted her and murdered her. He then dumped her body at Taylor Mountain, about an hour away from her home. Ted Bundy had murdered his first confirmed victim, and the police didn't have anything to go off of besides some bloody clothes and the fact that some of her possessions were missing. They had no leads. The attack on Karen, no leads. And we have to remember this is quite a while before the term serial killer was even commonly known or that we understood psychological profiling of murders. Usually murder is committed for power, lust, jealousy, or financial gain. But to think that there was a person capable of stalking, sexually assaulting, and murdering women for the sheer pleasure of it was far from being on any police radar. And sure, everyone probably was familiar with Jack the Ripper and the murder castle guy, H.H. Holmes, right? But at this time, police would never suspect that something just as sinister could be taking place in their college town. Unfortunately, before his four-year reign of terror was over, Ted Bundy would take the lives of nearly 30 victims, and many suspect that the true number is significantly higher. And that is where I'm going to leave you for part one. But because this is coming out after the holiday weekend, you will not have to wait very long for part two. It will be out this Sunday. In part two, we're going to really dive into the victims of Ted Bundy, and it's going to be intense. And we're also going to talk about his escapes. Yes, I said escapes, plural, from jail and from the police. But in the meantime, I want to hear from you, because this case in particular really puzzles me. I don't know what to believe about his childhood, because obviously his story, his family's stories, they all have changed quite a few times. So I don't know what's true or not. Did he experience abuse at a young age or at least witness abuse? Maybe. Is that a factor? I mean, if you grew up with a man who's allegedly swinging cats around and beating people, you could see how some of this could happen, right? Or if none of that is true, then how did he become who he became? Like, was Ted Bundy actually born to be a serial killer? I don't know. I don't know what I think, but I really want to hear your guys' takes on it. I'd also so appreciate if you like, subscribe, send this to a friend. But please take care of yourselves. I will see you this Sunday with part two. But as always, until then.